welcome to Worlds Apart. An old Russian saying has it that there are no former intelligence officers. The work of spies requires levels of dexterity, loyalty, and discretion that usually go far beyond field assignments. But what if serving one's country reveals something that goes against its most fundamental and cherished values? What then constitutes treason? Keeping mum about the abuse or sharing the dirty secrets with the public and potential enemies? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by John Kiriakou, a former CIA officer and a former senior investigator with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Mr. Kiriakou, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me.
Now, you had a pretty successful and illustrious career with the CIA, and I think at one point you became the chief of counterterrorism operations in Pakistan, which didn't take you that much time. And as I was reading about your professional story, I kept thinking or wondering, what were the qualities, the skills, perhaps personal traits that allowed you to advance across the ranks so fast?
Oh, that's a great question, actually. And I think that I was an unusual officer in that I was always the good cop in the good cop, bad cop scenario. I found success in getting targets, whether they knew they were targets or not, to like me. And invariably, they ended up doing things for me because they liked me. I never understood why or how many of my colleagues preferred to use force or threats. That just never seemed to me to be the smart way of going about things. I found, and this is something, frankly, that the FBI has practiced for many, many years, I found that if you establish a rapport with a person, you establish something of a friendly relationship with that person, they're far more likely to tell you what you want to know and to do something that you want them to do than if you use threats or threats of force.
You know, I don't know many former CIA officers except for you, or at least I'm not aware of them. But I think what strikes me now is that your approach is very much like the approach of the Russians or of the Soviets, because Soviet intelligence relied far more on personal relationship rather than technology, whereas the Americans and the Westerners in general, they were about bugging, you know, eavesdropping, but much less about establishing or actually using human psyche to get what they wanted from the people. Was it something that came natural to you, and do you have to sort of fake it, or is it something that you enjoy?
Well, you know, the first 7.5 years of my career at the CIA were in analysis. I just sat at a desk like thousands of other people and wrote analytic pieces for Washington policymakers. And in those early years of my career, my boss has mentioned a couple of times, you would be a good operations officer. And I would kind of chuckle and say, oh, well, that's nice of you to say. I don't really have any interest in being an operations officer. And then I got bored. I got bored with the analytic work and decided to try my hand at operations. And it was only then that I realized what they meant. I was very fortunate in that people just liked to be around me. I have varied interests. I can talk about everything from sports to the theater to politics to international affairs. And people liked doing that. And so I went into the analytic training, which was quite extensive. It takes a very long time. I found that I was a natural fit for that kind of work. I enjoyed it very much.
Now, most former intelligence officers that I've interacted with tend to have a very particular sense of patriotism, because I think one needs to have that sense in order to do what they're doing, to understand why they're doing that. And I wonder what it was like for you in the beginning of your career, your personal relationship with your country and what it stood for.
Oh, yes. You have to be very patriotic to take on work like this. But I'll tell you, you've hit on something that's very important here. On my very first day at the CIA, I put my right hand in the air and I swore an oath to uphold and to defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That's the oath that we take. I hate to think that that day in that room of 300 new employees, that I was the only one who actually meant it. You know, I believed for many years that we were the good guys, period. And so you could be either with us or you could be against us. And it was only after the 9/11 attacks, when we started doing things that I knew were patently illegal.
Mr. Kiriakou, can I press you a little bit here? Because sure. You were not being hired to run, I don't know, like some teacher's program. You knew that you were going to be doing some clandestine or secretive things. You were signing up for the Foreign Intelligence Service, after all. I mean, honestly, what was your own sort of degree of, you know, holding up your nose at that point? Because I'm sure you should have foreseen that there would be something that would go against what you are used to.
Oh, but there's a big difference between going against what you're used to and going against the Constitution. Everything that I was ever asked to do before 9/11 fell well within the confines of the law. Listen, I'm very happy to break the law. I'm very happy to break your law, if it means that I can recruit you to provide secrets to me. Remember, my job is to get you to commit espionage. In some cases, my job is to get you to commit treason. I'm very happy to do that. I don't care if I violate your law. It's the American Constitution that I can't violate. And so until 9/11, the job was great because I never, ever even approached a situation where I had to violate U.S. law.
Well, but I think your biggest problem with the CIA after 9/11 was participation in the so-called enhanced interrogation program. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think you remain the sole CIA agent at this point to go to jail in connection with that program, even though you explicitly refused to participate in it. Now, before we go into discussing the details, in your own moral universe, what was violated there? I mean, how do you explain this paradox to you? The fact that you simply, you know, spilled the beans about the wrongdoings and yet you were put to jail because of that.
I've always maintained that we are either going to be a nation of laws or we're not. We're either going to be a nation that respects human rights or we're not. We can't pretend to be this shining beacon of hope for the rest of the world, and then send teams around that same world to kill people or to torture people in secret prisons or to kidnap them and send them to third country torture chambers to be mutilated and beaten and starved and in some cases murdered. You can't be both things at the same time. Either we're going to be the good guys that we profess to be or we're not. And listen, I've said all along, that people can agree to disagree on whether or not you want to torture or to have a torture program. But in my view, torture was patently illegal. And so if you want to torture people, change the law.
But Mr. Kiriakou, just to clarify, I'm sure you knew about the targeted assassinations of foreign agents or leaders, for example, prior to your joining the CIA, for example, all these numerous attempts on Fidel Castro's life, to name just one individual. I mean, you had... did you have any problem with that on a moral basis, or you thought it was okay because it was within the U.S. law?
You're talking about very different phases here. The Church Committee and the Pike Committee hearings in 1975 utterly changed the way the CIA could do business. And Executive Order 12333 that was signed into effect by President Ford outlawed assassinations by the CIA. Furthermore, in 1993, with the inauguration of Bill Clinton, the CIA went through something called a cull, C-U-L-L, where the White House ordered the CIA to go through literally the file of every recruited agent that it had to fire those agents, to cut ties with those agents who had some sort of a human rights problem in their backgrounds. At least in the Clinton administration, the CIA had to take human rights seriously. Pre-1975, the CIA was was an anarchic organization going around the world, murdering world leaders and overthrowing governments.
Now, the highest point of your career came in 2002 with the raid and capture of Abu Zubaydah, who was considered Al-Qaeda's third ranking official at the time and somebody who's been waterboarded and tortured extensively. He spent more than two decades in Guantanamo with no prospect of either a trial and release. And the question that I have, given all the extremes that his psyche, his body were subjected to, why do you think the Americans are still keeping him alive? Because I don't understand trying to pretend that his right to life is worth anything when all the other rights are being so explicitly and so deliberately denied.
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. This is an example of American hypocrisy at its worst. We were told in 2002 that Abu Zubaydah was the number three in Al-Qaeda. That was just simply not true. Not only was he not the number three in Al-Qaeda, he was never even a member of Al-Qaeda. He was certainly a bad guy. He was certainly somebody who had helped Al-Qaeda by establishing the House of Martyrs safe house in Peshawar, Pakistan, by establishing Al-Qaeda's two training camps in Kandahar and Helmand provinces in southern Afghanistan. He was something of a logistician for Al-Qaeda, but he was never a member, and he was certainly not the number three. Now, that's mistake number one. Mistake number two, this is something that we didn't know until 2005. Abu Zubaydah had a cousin, a first cousin, who was also named Abu Zubaydah. And so the CIA is gathering intelligence on the two Abu Zubaydahs, not knowing that there are two. And we're saying, my God, he's doing this operation in Jordan. Oh, my God, he's in Afghanistan. He's in Pakistan. He's in London. He looked like a terrorist Superman. Not realizing, again, that it was two separate people. And so in our files and in our minds, we built this man up to be one of the most dangerous terrorists in the world. He was not. And then we captured him, we tortured him, we beat him, we even removed his eye, and then made a decision that even though we knew he was the wrong person, he knew so much about the torture program because of what he had endured personally, that we could never release him from Guantanamo under any circumstances.
Mr. Kiriakou, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few seconds. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with John Kiriakou, a former CIA officer and a former senior investigator with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Mr. Kiriakou, as I was preparing for this interview and reading about your life story, I kept thinking about Alexander Solzhenitsyn, whom the Americans like to quote so much, especially his saying that the line between good and evil runs not through states or countries, but right through every human heart. And what was ironic to me is that Barack Obama, who was in office when you were sentenced and who knew about the, you know, the life story of Abu Zubaydah as well, who likes quoting Solzhenitsyn, at least he has recommended his books, he was very... very critical of the cruelty of the Soviet regime, for example, and yet he did absolutely nothing, either in your case or in the case of this man whose life is essentially being turned into everlasting torture. I wonder if that adds any moral poignancy to this whole situation.
Here in the United States, the Justice Department likes to use the Espionage Act to prosecute national security whistleblowers. Between the passage of the Espionage Act in 1917 and the election of Barack Obama, who became president in 2009, three Americans from 1917 to 2009 were prosecuted for speaking with the media. Just under Barack Obama, eight national security whistleblowers were prosecuted for speaking to the media. That's almost three times as many as all previous presidents combined. One of the things that we learned very quickly about Barack Obama was that he was not a friend of transparency. He was not a friend of whistleblowers. And he was very, very easily influenced by the CIA and by the rest of the intelligence community, perhaps because he came to the presidency with no foreign policy experience, or perhaps because he just believed in the mission of the CIA and the U.S. intelligence services. Remember, it was Barack Obama who had a kill list drawn up every Tuesday morning by the National Security Council to list the people who were to be killed that week with drones. These are people who have never been charged with a crime. So I was never under the belief that Obama was a friend of transparency.
I'm very interested about this paradox because on the one hand, enhanced interrogation techniques, and on the other hand, civil liberties, because they are the total polar opposites of one another. And it is so interesting psychologically that it is your society that extols personal freedom so much, that are so foundational to your national identity, that would come up with this program and even try to sort of legitimize it under the veneer of renaming it into something else. I wonder if that was because at the end of the day, it was targeting foreigners rather than Americans, that, you know, to foreigners, such treatment, perhaps that humanity perhaps is somehow lower than that of Americans. How would you explain this very difficult and very polar split?
I'm actually more cynical about it than you are. I think you're being too kind in that, along with the torture program, the rendition program, the secret prison program, we also saw the warrantless wiretapping of American citizens. NSA is forbidden by law, for example, for intercepting or to intercept the communication of American citizens. And yet they intercept the communication of literally all American citizens, not just phone calls, but text messages and emails as well. We now know from the Twitter files that NSA also collects metadata from every social media company on American citizens. That is patently illegal. Now, we wouldn't have known this had Edward Snowden not told us. And Congress has not had the guts to stand up and say this is wrong. If we're going to be, again, if we're going to be a country that that respects civil liberties and individual freedoms, then we should be that country.
As far as I'm concerned, collecting the data on all your citizens is pointless. It's very expensive, but it's pointless. You would never have enough analysts to sift through all that information. It makes no sense. And to some extent, it's also like manifested in the American foreign policy, because the Americans often try to impose this very total control that comes back to hurt them. I mean, I wonder if the CIA ever looked, and we associate intelligence with intelligence, that is the ability to analyze. So I wonder if the CIA has ever analyzed the effectiveness of their own actions.
No. No, they haven't. I'm so glad that you said that, because here in the United States, like in many countries, but here in the United States especially, we like to think that we are the smartest, we are the best, we have the best ideas. When we're in a room with people from foreign countries, they all gather around us to hear our wisdom and to follow our leadership. And that is just simply ridiculous. You can't possibly have enough analysts to pour through this information. So why collect it in the first place? The legality or illegality aside, why bother to collect it in the first place? And another thing is, you know, the CIA, like any big lumbering bureaucracy, is slow to make decisions, slow to change its policies, and slow to recognize its own mistakes. And so you find the CIA doubling down on many of these decisions, only to realize when it's far too late that the decision was wrong in the first place. I think that that's what we've seen in this series of decisions, going all the way back to October of 2001 with passage of the Patriot Act. It's just wrong. It's not just wrong, it's stupid. And now you've restricted civil liberties. And how do you get out of that when these restrictions are being challenged on constitutional grounds? You have to argue that the Constitution was wrong or was short-sighted, or that you're smarter than the founding fathers were, or that you're smarter than the Supreme Court is. This is going to be a fight that we're going to have to continue for generations.
One of the tendencies that I think your culture, political culture, has is this hyperbolic moralizing. You're setting up such a high moral standards for others and very, very low standards for yourself, or at least for your politicians, perhaps not for the ordinary people. But what I'm interested in is this sort of double standard of requiring far more from your adversaries than from yourself. I think I see it all around foreign policy right now. I think the United States uses this moralizing / demonizing with respect in relation with Russia and China, its adversaries. But it's also very lenient when it comes to moral consistency with its allies, like Israel, for example. Is it instrumental, or the Americans simply don't see it?
First of all, your point is exactly right. There is this this hypocritical double standard, especially in foreign policy. Israel is a great example. Saudi Arabia is another great example. You know, we pretend that we have this special relationship with Saudi Arabia. We don't. We buy their oil and they buy our weapon systems. And really, that's the extent of the relationship. But with Israel, this is probably the best example. When I was serving overseas, in one case, I was the embassy human rights officer. So one day, the host government broke up a peaceful pro-democracy demonstration. They arrested a 15-year-old boy. They took him back to the police station and they beat him to death. And then they called the parents and told them to come by the police station and pick up the body. So I went in to see the Minister of Interior and I said, "Your Highness, you cannot beat to death a child and get away with it. I'm going to have to write this up and I'm going to have to inform Congress," because we had a robust arms sales program with this country. Well, what do you think his reaction would be when 15 minutes after I leave his office, the CIA station chief enters the office and says, "Don't listen to the human rights guy. We want you to open a secret prison here where we can torture people, or better yet, you torture them, and then you give us a transcript of what they said under torture." Do you think he's going to listen to me? Or do you think he's going to listen to the CIA station chief? And that's, to me, indicative of this immoral double standard we have with our friends.
What you're talking about, the secret prison, reminds me of Gaza, which is a big open sky prison. It's not secretive, but people are being subjected there to torture for many, many generations. Their basic rights are being denied. And yet Israel justifies it by its right to defend itself, just like the America after 9/11, and even its right to exist. And I think George W. Bush also used some sort of invocation of the right to exist. You know, they hate us because of our lifestyle, not because we do something bad to them. I wonder if you think that Israel would be able to treat Gazans in such a way if it weren't for the American backing.
Absolutely not. But the Israelis know that they essentially control the American administration and Congress. It's because of the generations of support that Jewish groups and pro-Israel groups in the United States have provided to members of Congress. Last night, we had a presidential debate for the Republican nomination for president. And all four of the participants in the debate agreed that we should give unrestricted, unfettered support to Israel. And all four of these presidential candidates criticized the Biden administration only because the Biden administration made a statement that the Israelis should make more of an effort to respect human rights. Can you imagine? They were angry and upset because the president called for respect for human rights. Their position being, and this is really the mainstream position in the Washington political class, that the Israelis should be allowed to do literally anything they want, and that means to kill anybody they want. And nobody seems to have any problem with that. Well, you and I both know that's a crime against humanity. So why aren't we doing something about it?
Well, I tell you why, because Israel, like the United States, are going not for sufficient, but for absolute security. And to some extent, we also see the manifestation of that in Ukraine, where the Ukrainians are being acted on to continue their fighting, even though they're not being adequately supplied by either the weapons or their own manpower is running out very, very quickly. My last question to you is, do you think the Americans would ever agree to leave and let leave? Because otherwise, I don't see any other outcome than a kinetic clash between your and my country.
I hate to say, but you're right. And I'll remind you, too, that it's the United States that has stood in the way of any kind of peace talks between Russia and Ukraine. It's the United States that has rejected any such meetings. Remember, there was a so-called peace conference in Saudi Arabia months ago, and the Russian government wasn't invited. Well, whose stupid idea was that? There's a joke that I'm sure that you've heard that's made the rounds, that the United States is willing to fight to the last Ukrainian.
This is not a question of morals. This is a question of policy. If the United States would agree that, you know, it can enjoy the modicum of security, it's still the one of the most powerful countries in the world, but it cannot have an absolute control. Do you think it's intelligent enough, its current CIA personnel, are they intelligent enough to understand that there is no way around of compromising on that?
Oh, no, you're exactly right. And I think that the CIA does understand that, but there's a very deep divide between intelligence and policy on this issue. I think that there was a step forward with Lloyd Austin's most recent trip to Ukraine, where by all accounts, he said, we need to start wrapping this up. Congress is turning. They don't want to provide any more money. It's too expensive. We can't afford it. There's no end in sight. Sanctions against Russia haven't worked. If anything, they've helped to strengthen the Russian economy. And it's time to finish this and move on. So I think that incrementally, we're getting there.
We are where we are, but we also, as you said, have to finish here. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.